Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about rock and roll music from such sources as the News and Observer, The Week magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. This opening number, Speed of Light, brought to us by Sarah Lee Guthrie. We'll be hearing more about and from Sarah Lee Guthrie later on in today's program. But first, these trivia questions. Our trivia questions come to us today from Uncle John's Bathroom Reader, Plunges into Music, 2007. Question number one, which artist produced the shortest hit single on record? Was it A, Duane Eddy, B, Liberace, C, Guy Lombardo, or D, Yanni? Hint, this instrumental song was only 77 seconds long. And question number two, which band was the first American pop band allowed to tour the Soviet Union? Was it A, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, or just the Dirt Band, B, Paul Revere and the Raiders, C, the Beach Boys, or D, Duke Ellington? Hint, here's a snippet from the album released prior to that 1997 tour of the USSR. This song, by the way, is called The Raleigh-Durham Reel. What's the name of this band playing this song, The Raleigh-Durham Reel? This is the first American pop band allowed to tour USSR. Answers to these important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. The transition section for today's program is brought to us by Today in Music, www.musicorb.com. And today is the 10th and 11th of June. Births in music history on June the 10th include Frederick Lowe. He's the composer, Lerner and Lowe, born on this day, June the 10th, 1904. John William Stevens, the jazz drummer, born on this day, June the 10th, 1940. Shirley Owens Alston, singer, from the Shirelles, Soldier Boy. She was born on June the 10th, 1941. And Matthew Fisher, keyboardist for Poco Harum, born on June the 10th, 1946. Deaths in music history on June the 10th include, back in 1982 on June the 10th, it was Addie Mickey Harris of the Shirelles, Mama Said, dies at age 42. And back 10 years after that, 1992, Hachidal Nakamura, the composer from Sukiyaki, dies at age 61 of heart failure. And finally, back in 2004, on June the 10th, it was Ray Charles passing away, Grammy-winning crooner who blended gospel and blues and such crowd pleasers as What I Say and ballads like Georgia on My Mind. He was 73 years old. Births in music history on June the 11th include Richard George Strauss, the composer, Don Quixote, born on that day, June 11th, 1864. And back in 1904, on June the 11th, Clarence Pine Top Smith, the jazz pianist and singer, was born. And back in 1939, on June the 11th, Wilma Burgess, the country pop singer, was born. And finally, back in 1952, Donnie Van Zant, the rock vocalist, was born on June the 11th. Deaths in music history on June the 11th include Clyde McCoy, the jazz trumpeter, Wawa Sound. He died at the age of 86 back on June the 11th, 1990. Miscellany in music history on June the 10th and 11th. Well, back in 1966 on these days, it was the Beatles recording Rain, the first to ever use reverse tapes. And back in 1972, Elvis Presley records a live album at New York's Madison Square Garden on these days. And on June the 10th, 1985, 1991, and 1996, those 3 years, the Music City News Country Awards were awarded. Back in 85, it was to the Statler Brothers and Barbara Mandrell. Back in 91, on June the 10th, it was Ricky Van Shelton. And back in 1996, on June the 10th, it was Alan Jackson. Back in 1977, on June the 10th, I'm Your Boogeyman by KC and the Sunshine Band peaks at number one. And back in 1966, on June the 10th and 11th, it was Paint It Black by the Rolling Stones peaking at number one. Back in 69, David Bowie releases Space Odyssey. Also that same year, The Ballad of John and Yoko by the Beatles hits number one this weekend. Back in 1976 on these days, it was Australian band AC/DC begin their first headline tour of Great Britain. Back in 1964 this weekend, it was the Chicago Police breaking up a Rolling Stones press conference. And finally, in 1964, Queen Elizabeth orders the Beatles to her birthday party. And they attend. And in local rock news, we see this article by David Menconi, News and Observer, published on the 5th of June, 2011, entitled, The Decemberists Can Make Even Simple Hard. The Decemberists, who play June the 11th in Raleigh, have never been the most straightforward bunch. They've recorded some of the most ornate and delicately complex music in recent memory, drawing on everything from Japanese folk tales to Irish mythology. By contrast, the group's new album, which was actually released back in January of 2011, The King is Dead, is its most uncomplicated ever. 10 songs, 40 minutes, and no high-concept underpinnings to speak of, which was harder to pull off than you'd think.
And it's 1, 2, 3 on the wrong side of Lee. What were you meant for? What were you meant for? And it's 7, 8, 9 Get your shuffle back in line. And if you ever make it to 10, you won't make it again. And if you ever make it to 10, you won't make it again.
You'd think you could just take good musicians who like each other, throw everyone into a room, and let them go. But it's more difficult than that. We had to try not to overthink simple things too much. But in a lot of ways, it's more satisfying just to play good songs and get in the zone, make them sound right without drawing the focus away from the song itself. If there's a unifying concept at work on King, it's more in terms of overall sound and feel than lyrical content. It's downright countryfied, with a jingle-jangle twang at tempos ranging from stately waltz to pastoral lope. Contributing to the rustic vibe is alternative country siren Gillian Welch of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou fame, who serves as Decemberist frontman Colin McMilloy's vocal foil. Also prominent in a cameo role is R.E.M.'s Peter Buck. Buck turns up on 3 King tracks, playing guitar and mandolin, and Calamity Song bears the distinctive chime of his 12-string guitar. Colin has always channeled so many R.E.M. influences into his songs, Query said. I'm not sure he'd ever been afraid to make them obvious, but this was him deciding even more not to worry if his R.E.M. or Neil Young obsessions were coming through. He's unique enough in his songwriting approach that it's always still his. Article skips down and ends with this. The King is Dead went all the way to number one, setting up a large venue summer tour that included the downtown Raleigh Amphitheater. It was definitely a little surreal to see us there at number one, Query said. The main way it impacted me was to make me feel very contemplative about the last 10 years and all the things that got us here. So I spent that day writing emails and calling people who'd helped. We have a huge team and such a supportive community in Portland, which we're thankful for. The band plugs away doing our thing, and we need a team and a community. It was more about that than we're finally number one. That was never a goal, because you have so little control over that, like none. And this next article comes to us from Uncle John's Bathroom Reader Plunges into Music, 2007. Mozart's Concerto in G Major for Piano and Starling. Polly doesn't want a cracker. She wants a piano, a pen, and some blank sheet music. European starlings have long been known as extraordinarily musical and teachable songbirds. Tales of their abilities go back to the ancient Greeks and are even mentioned by Shakespeare in Henry IV. In 1990, Meredith J. West, professor of wildlife and biology, and Andrew P. King, professor of psychology, both of Indiana University, published the results of a study in American Scientist magazine. Over the course of 10 years, they studied 14 pet starlings in a variety of social settings, from a lot of interaction with humans to nearly none. They compared recordings of the different birds to gauge whether they just mimicked or if they created their own music. Turns out, they do both. Article skips down. As for music, the birds quickly learn melodies that were played or whistled to them, but the most curious thing West and King found was that regardless of what the starlings learned, once they learned it, they changed it and made it their own. They'd sing the beginning of a tune, then end it with part of another, repeatedly. They almost never played a tune as they had originally learned it from their owners. They were improvising, and they did it with human speech they'd learned, too. So why were the birds rewriting songs and phrases? West cites another part of the findings. Not only that starlings learn from those around them, but that they must like it or get rewarded for it somehow. Some of that reward may be simply to stimulate social contact. And isn't that at least one reason humans make music? Evidence strongly suggests that a give and take of that kind must have happened between Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart and his own pet starling. On May 27, 1784, Mozart walked into a Vienna, Austria pet shop and bought himself a European starling. Later that day, the 28-year-old composer wrote a short note in his ledger next to a note about the purchase of the bird. A short, jotted musical score consisting of 5 measures and 17 notes, along with the words, "Das war schön." That was beautiful. Was it a tune the bird had sung? Music historians believe so, and it's also the melodic theme of the final movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto in G Major, which was catalogued as finished a month earlier, in April, but hadn't yet been performed in public. Did Mozart borrow the tune from the bird and add it to his concerto? Nobody knows for sure, but if he had finished the piece with the melodic theme as it was in April, why would he remark, "Das war schon," in May? We'll never know for sure what happened, but it does make you wonder. And it's not the only time the bird is suspected of influencing the master's work. Mozart's pet starling died on June 4, 1787. He gave it a lavish funeral. Several friends attended and hymns were sung as it was lowered into its little grave. He even wrote an elegy for the bird, a section of which reads, "A little fool lies here whom I held dear, a starling in the prime of his brief time." A month later, Mozart finished a short composition for 6 instruments titled A Musical Joke. It is, nearly all critics agree, incoherent, rambling, unstructured, off-key, and just plain bad. In other words, says Professor West of Indiana University, the piece contains the compositional autograph of a starling. So what do you know about today's featured artist, Sarah Lee Guthrie? Well, we see this information given to us by www.folkways.si, standing for Smithsonian Institute, .edu. Gifted singer-songwriter Sarah Lee Guthrie brings charm, freshness, and feelings to her debut recording of music for children and families, joined by her husband, Johnny Irion, their two young daughters, and a host of other family and friends, including Arlo Guthrie, Pete Seeger, and Tao Rodriguez Seeger. Guthrie presents thoughtful yet playful recordings of traditional songs and new compositions. The album includes three songs featuring lyrics by Woody Guthrie, never before put to music, and eight songs written by Sarah Lee and family. Go Wagaloo, that's spelled W-A-G-G-A-L-O-O, name of the album, continues the Guthrie song-making tradition forged by Sarah's grandfather, Woody Guthrie. It's for children of all ages.
Coming in from London, from over the pole, flying in a big airliner, chicken flying everywhere around the plane. No, we couldn't feel much finer. Coming into Los Angeles, bringing in a couple.
And this information from www.starpulse.com by Eric Haig. While she may not have envisioned it early on, Sarah Lee Guthrie, the daughter of Arlo Guthrie and granddaughter of Woody Guthrie, ended up answering the call of family tradition, releasing her self-titled debut in 2001. Careful observers will notice that her first recorded appearance was as a toddler vocalist on Dad's 1981 album, Power of Love. As an adolescent, she would also sing with her dad on the Grammy-nominated children's album, Woody's 20 Grows Big Songs. In high school, however, she was more prone to listening to punk albums than thinking about a career as a folk singer. Nevertheless, she spent the years directly after high school on the road with Arlo, initially as road manager and then as part of the band. Her live debut was with family and friends at Carnegie Hall. In 1997, she met her future husband, Johnny Irion, once a member of North Carolina's alt-rockers, Queen Sarah Saturday. This is a song from Song for My Father, the album. And this was her contribution as dedicated to her dad, Arlo Guthrie. And from www.glidemagazine.com, we see this interview with Sarah Lee Guthrie and her husband, Johnny Irion, by Leslie Michelle DeRoe, March the 15th, 2011. What a wonderful sound when two beautiful voices converge in harmony to form a melody that's so pleasant, you feel as if you could reach out and touch it. It may actually surprise you when you first hear the crystal clear vocals of Sarah Lee Guthrie and Johnny Irion on their new record, Bright Examples, because there is so little noise. You know, all that in-studio acrobatics that can sometimes wipe out a pristine moment in order to create a so-called fuller sound. It's just these intimate moments that make an album like Bright Example stand out from the crowd. And what they have captured while recording in an old converted church in Woodstock, New York, is something quite pure and old-fashioned, music as music. Sarah Lee Guthrie and her husband and musical partner, Johnny Irion, are back with a wonderful CD of focused tunes that tell stories of love, spirit, home, and inspiration from the world around them. Taking some time to talk to Glide on a winter morning that saw 3 feet of fresh snow at their home in Massachusetts, they shared with us how the new CD was created, their life in the music business, and how a punk chick and a rock dude became two of the best vocalists in the world of folk and Americana music.
You can't hide it.
Even with your dad being Arlo Guthrie, you didn't think you would be a musician? No, I really didn't. I wanted to be as normal as possible. We were like the Adams family in our small town, she laughs. I just wanted to be normal. I went to L.A. and got a job at a department store. I was just thinking, not music at all. Then I realized that I'd just magnified by it. Not magnified, but like a magnet to me. It was like, oh, I don't know, want to hang out with them. I want to hang out with the musicians. She laughs again, because that was normal. When did you realize that you could sing and that you had a beautiful voice? I'm getting there, she laughs. I got thrown into the fire when I was 14 years old and had to sing backup with my dad, and he asked me to sing a solo song that night in front of like 7,000 people. I had the guts to do it, and I did it. At that point, I might have had a little spark, she laughs, but I didn't notice it, but I was into punk rock music. I was not going to be singing folk rock music, she laughs. Yeah, how in the world did you go from there to here? Johnny was a rock dude, and you were a punk chick with a mohawk.
I got a lazy tongue that I like to use, and with my lazy tongue, I got nothing to lose. So people talk to me, and they talk so clear, and then, well, I talk back, and they all come to hear my lazy tongue. Sounds so sweet.
I have no idea, really. The leap happened. It went from, like, punk rock to country. I don't know how, she laughs. Like it just switched. Then I met Johnny, and he's entirely into the Black Crows, even though they were singing rock and roll. They were listening to Sweethearts of the Rodeo, too. And so I was really turned on at that point. So, yeah, I went straight to country, and not just like country. I'm thinking like George Jones, Patsy Cline, and a lot of that kind of country. And when I found out all the stuff, I really figured out what it was really all about, because I was trying to find it, I suppose. Punk rock was just sort of a way of expressing myself as a teenager. But certainly, when I started to hear that stuff, and I was like, this is just so good, and then that really kind of led me to other, like the country of the day. And Johnny was playing all these great blues records for me that I had never heard, and my roommate was playing the Rolling Stones for me, and I was like, whoa! And Johnny was playing the Beach Boys, and I was like, I get it now. I know what this whole music thing stuff, and I know why. So it was a sort of natural progression, I suppose. Do you have a favorite musician that you still go back to for inspiration? Yeah, I think definitely it's some of the 60s pop stuff, from the Buffalo Springfield to the Beatles and the Beach Boys, says Johnny Irion. And just when there was an electricity in the air that took songs into a different realm, I definitely get inspired when I get back and listen to that stuff. It gets my blood moving. The article skips down and ends with this.
Down in Alabama, 1955. Not many of us here tonight were then alive.
Do you have any advice for anyone who is writing poetry or lyrics in a notebook and maybe dreaming of being on a stage one day? It would be the same thing that people have always told me, which is to keep writing, keep trying, and keep working and keep doing it. It's actually a craft, and it may seem magical, but I think hard work pays off also. And that's something that I've learned throughout the years, is that you can't just sit down and wait for inspiration. We kind of treat it around here as a job, and we work at it and keep working at it, and there's always something more to learn. And do you think that 20 or 30 years down the line you're still going to be doing this? Oh, I don't know. I dream about my second life, she laughs. I love doing this, and I think I always will, because I have so many reasons to. And even if my dreams come true and I get to be a country girl and garden and make pottery, that I will still write and give the gift of song, you know. I found myself here. I think I belong here. And I was just reading something the other day that it's a gift. And you have to give it back, and so I give it to people who would appreciate it. So I'm spreading the love, and I feel like I will continue to do so. And we'll close out today's program with Sarah Lee Guthrie doing Target on Your Heart. But first, this final article. The Ringo That Might Have Been. This is from The Week magazine, June the 10th, 1955. 2011. It's hard to picture Ringo Starr as a retired factory worker, said Cole Moreton in the London Daily Mail. Yet had fate not intervened back in 1962, that might have been his reality today. Starr was working in a factory when he got an offer to play drums for a local band. He was then approached to play a gig with the Beatles. Within Liverpool, I was more known than them, says Starr, 70 years old. They were lucky to get me. At that time, Starr didn't see a future in music. We didn't think it would last. Even Paul thought, well, I'll probably end up as a writer. So did John. George was going to have a garage. I was an apprentice engineer, which was a big thing in my family. All my uncles and aunties came over to try and tell me that drumming was okay as a hobby. Half a century later, he and Paul McCartney are the last remaining Beatles. He likes to think he's the only one, says Starr a bit testily. He still feels that he never got his due. Why hasn't he been knighted like Sir Paul? People have tried campaigns, but it never goes anywhere. Maybe you should just start one. That's why I called my last album, Why Not?
Time waits for nobody. And nobody waits for time. Life is for the living.
So how'd you do on those trivia questions today? Question number one had to do with which artist produced the shortest hit single on record. That was Duane Eddy, performed the shortest hit single on record. This 1959 title was Some Kind of Earthquake, and it was only 77 seconds long. Duane Eddy is also known for such guitar instrumentals as Rebel Rouser and Peter Gunn, and Because They're Young. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame back in 1994. And answer number two, which band was the first American pop band allowed to tour the USSR? That was the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, or just the Dirt Band. Their televised appearance on this 1977 tour was watched by an estimated 145 million people. This band, founded in Long Beach, California in 1966, won several country music awards and Grammy awards between 1989 and 2005. So we end up today's program on the lighter side with these musical questions from Uncle John's Bathroom Reader. You may remember the rumors concerning what happens when you play certain songs backwards. That is, you hear naughty words, secret messages about the future, about the artist, or from the devil. These were frequently urban legends started by teenagers to confound their parents. You may have also heard this one. What do you get when you play country music backwards? Well, you get your car back, your dog back, your job back, and your wife back. So this one, then, is what do you get if you play New Age music backwards? New Age music is the answer.
That boy ain't telling nothing but lies. I heard him backstage, and I want to show.
Sarah Lee Guthrie. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. If you have a suggestion for an artist, group, or genre of music to feature on Rock Review, please leave me a message, Randy Thompson, at 832-5138. So long until next time.
He stood you up again.